Hello, and welcome to another episode of Robbinsdale Revisited. In today's episode, we'll talk about the busy years that followed the end of World War II. Like many cities, Robbinsdale experienced a baby boom and a polio epidemic in the late 1940s. During the war, the Robbinsdale Airport was home to the Robbinsdale Civil Air Patrol, but the airport was closed in 1945. At a special election in 1947, voters overwhelmingly supported municipal liquor. The resulting profits benefited the city over the years. The Robbinsdale City Band is a point of local pride, and it won the Minnesota State Fair Championship for the third time in a row in 1947. The city itself continues to grow, with Lee Elementary School opening in 1948 and a new fire and police station in 1949. Also, the American Legion Westfall Post 251 constructed a new clubhouse in 1949. Now, Robbinsdale Historical Society President Pete Ritchie will tell us more.
Just to fill in a little more details about the Robbinsdale Civilian Air Patrol, you got 40 flyers and a 25 crew on the ground crew. These are the men and women of the Robbinsdale Civil Air Patrol. They're part of the Minnesota State Guard, and they had to complete a 230-hour ground school. And then they had to go through like a basic training and a specialized airport training. The Robbinsdale Squadron had 23 planes. They had 50 to 75 horsepower, two-seater Cubs. Their cruising speeds ranged from 80 to 90 miles an hour. And they could fly as fast as 100 and as slow as 60 miles an hour. The slower speed was of high value for scouting. Their ceilings averaged about 13,000 feet. But private pilots were restricted to altitudes below 3,500 unless they carried two-way radios. The flyers were all volunteer without compensation of any kind. They furnished their own planes, services, gas, and oil. The Robbinsdale Airport closed after the war. It was located just north of town where Welcome Park is today. 11 women met at the Red Cross nutrition class to learn how to feed their families under World War II shortages. So when I used to talk to people, and like every historical society, I think, in the Twin Cities and probably in the country, and of course, I was selling the book The Greatest Generation when it came out, and I never used that term until Brokaw brought out that book, and now it just sticks. But, you know, we all have large collections of things from The Greatest Generation because a lot of these little historical societies were started by those people. And so we have their yearbooks and we have their scrapbooks and we have their letter jackets and all the things that that their children brought to us. And but whenever you talk to any of them about World War II, you know, a lot of them will mention things like rationing. They'll mention things like in Robbinsdale, lots of people went and worked up in the munitions plants in Arden Hills. I think there may have even been a special train that brought people up there, or they carpooled or they bussed, and men and women worked up there. And of course, one of these people gave us this great big aerial photo of the munition plant in Arden Hills. And I kept wondering why we have it in the museum, because that has nothing to do with Robbinsdale. But then it was explained to me that so many Robbinsdalians, as we call ourselves, went up to Arden Hills to work in the munitions plant. So a lot of people remember the rationing. There was rationing of certain foods like meat and sugar and shortening, certainly rationing of gasoline. People remember this great big scrap metal pile that we had over on Regent Avenue, and there were paper drives, lots of recycling went on, and the American Legion led some of those efforts. Of course, there was the members of the local draft board were eyed up as if they were Gestapo agents. And the billboard downtown, you know, that listed all the GIs either had that blue or gold star up there. And people would go there and check it, just like they might check social media these days, just to see what was happening with people. There was, you know, whenever somebody had four pretty good tires on their car, they drew a lot of envy. Tuesdays were meatless. There was a lack of cigarettes. There wasn't enough candy bars. People would do strange things with bacon grease, like you could make a marvelous pie and marvelous pie crusts out of bacon grease. They learned to drink unsweetened coffee because they needed to save the sugar for their cake. And residents were recruited as air raid wardens. And we have all of the civil defense uniforms here in our closet. And they, at first, they look like they're made of polyester, but they may, They're made out of the itchiest, most unpleasant wool you can possibly imagine. And we actually have an Air Raid Warden helmet here and a little civil defense sticker that says, you know, CD Robbinsdale. So it was just, there was a lot of organization and a lot of home front activity here in Robbinsdale. And the war touched you no matter where you were. But it's really after the war, the Robbinsdale just starts to fill in and grow. So McNair Manor, this big development that was in the south part of the city, they had built some houses out there in the 1920s, maybe a couple in the 1930s. But after World War II, the Cape Cods, the split-level ranches start filling in that entire neighborhood. Sandborg Park starts to fill in again with Cape Cods. This side of Victor Memorial Drive starts filling in. And one of the last WPA grants that Robbinsdale gets is $145,000 for sewers and infrastructure. And so those start getting laid in. Sonneson, who eventually had bought the Robbinsdale Post, and his name was Sonny Sonneson, of course, he writes this glowing editorial that gets printed in the Minneapolis Star Tribune about how Robbinsdale is his home and it's just great here and you guys would love it. You should come up here. And the funny thing in the article is you show this picture of this beautiful house over on Crystal Lake that's sort of a Moorish fantasy of a house. And he says, this is a typical home in Robbinsdale. And it's this, you know, really elaborate red-tiled roof, stuccoed thing that has kind of Moorish and Spanish accents to it. It doesn't look anything like a typical home in Robbinsdale. But again, Robbinsdale has always had its boosters. And after World War II, these people just really spring into action and there's money to be made in the real estate. And all of our civic organizations are growing. The American Legion guys start building their own Legion Hall. And they left us these beautiful 1949 color photos of these guys laying cinder blocks. But that's all you see in these pictures. It's just them putting up this cinder block structure that eventually becomes the American Legion Hall. And they expanded that many times over the years. And then it started shrinking, you know, in the 1990s for various reasons. The membership just was declining and declining. And by its last few years, it had become a Russian restaurant. The Legion still had a little bar off in one corner, but the rest of the building was being used for other things. But it was built by the bare hands of these guys that just came back from World War II, and they loved their American Legion so much, and they kept it populated. And those guys continued all these civic programs through the 50s, 60s, and even when I was a kid in the 70s, they had ice skating races that they ran on Crystal Lake. They had their little league, and they had dog sled races and dog races out on Crystal Lake, and they were just a potent political force and a great organization, and we sort of miss them because they're gone now. But they really had a long good run here in Robbinsdale. And we also mentioned the Lions Club comes into its own in the 1940s. The Diggers Garden Club is still with us. The Lions Club is still with us. We mentioned Grazier Park gets built and the Beltway comes over to Crystal Lake. It's at this time that the Robbins Mansion is demolished. I've heard a couple different stories about it. The Robbins Mansion sat about where Highway 100 crosses Twin Lake. One story was that the highway department needed to remove it because it was in the way of the causeway and the way they were going to cross Twin Lake with the Beltline or Highway 100. The other story I've heard is the guy who lived next door just thought it was an eyesore. It had been sitting empty for about 10 years. It had a caretaker family through the 1930s, but eventually Edith Robbins, who at that time owned the house, didn't want to pay them anymore, and she just boarded it up. The other story we have is that a couple kids broke into it right before they tore it down, and they just went through it, and they said there were trunks full of old dresses, and there were books, and so the house was still full of stuff. I don't know how much of that stuff got out of there. I know some of the Robbins family correspondents made it out of there, but I can't help but wonder what was in those trunks up in the attics, and when the bulldozers hit it, were those trunks still there? For many years, there would be people that would say that they could find some of the stone foundation that was part of the house. And I've never really been able to verify that. I think it's probably pretty likely that the neighbors thought it was an eyesore, and Edith Robbins just agreed to have it torn down. So we lost the Robbins Mansion, but Grazier Park is built, and the area where the Robbins Mansion was, just to the south of where the highway crosses the lake, becomes Lions Park, and the Lions Club takes care of that. It never gets the beautiful stone picnic tables that Grazier Park did, but when I was a kid, it was used a lot more than Grazier Park. That's where everybody went for family fun and picnics. It had a boat launch. The boat launch is still there, but there were a lot more people launching their boat there. There was a swimming beach there, and Twin Lake was a better lake to swim in than Crystal Lake. There was another swimming beach on the Brooklyn Center side, and one of the great stories about the swimming beach is they were advertising in the newspaper that you should send your kids out to get swimming lessons, and of course Vern Gagne was the swimming teacher at Twin Lake. So I wonder how many kids were out there swimming around and have Vern Gagne as their teacher and can still remember that, and did they do any wrestling on the side. In 1949, Lee School is all built and the PTA is organized. There's somebody named Ms. Walker, and she's the first president. And then there's KSDP has a barn dance at Robbinsdale High School, which doesn't seem like that big a deal. But KSDP at that time had this program that was on the air, and it was kind of like a Grand Old Opry type program. And they would have cowboy songs and silly country bumpkin and hayseed jokes. And they had a great big cast of characters. So when they came to town, it was kind of like having Hee Haw or the Grand Old Opry show up at your high school and do a command performance. And so this was a big deal. And they came out, and the name of the program was the Sweet Valley Barn Dance. So the high schoolers in the whole town showed up for that, and people were thrilled about that. The neighborhood I grew up in McNair Manor, at this time is filling out in my house, was built in 1944. So we always think of the big boom as coming after the war, and certainly there were a lot of houses built then, but there were people that saw this coming and builders that took advantage of these empty lots that were platted out in the 1920s. Never got built on because of lack of infrastructure, and then because of the Depression. And they started building these little Cape Cods that were just right for the new families that were moving into the city and the people that were at that time, people were just starting to move out into the suburbs from North Minneapolis. So we've got all sorts of memorabilia from the 1940s in the museum. One of the things that I've always noticed is that letter jackets, sweaters, pennant banners from the high school of the 1940s are all purple and gold. And the story I've heard about that is the high school actually had to change its colors from purple and gold to blue and gold because somebody screwed up a band uniform order. And they ordered all the band uniforms in blue and gold, and E.J. Cooper and Milo Milky, when they were approached and said, look, we got to get new band uniforms, they came in the wrong color. They just said, you know what, it's time to change the school colors to blue and gold. And they were blue and gold forever after that. In fact, we were talking about the Westfall American Legion, and one of the strangest things that happened to that building is at some point they just decided they would paint it blue and gold to represent the high school colors. The high school had been closed for some time, but they still decided that those were Robbinsdale's colors, blue and gold. The Historical Society sign out front is blue and gold. So we still honor those colors, even if they weren't the original colors of the high school. And the homecoming events just become great big things in Robbinsdale. We got the parades, and the high school is just the thriving institution in town. Another one of the items that we associate with the 1940s here at the Historical Society is the Gauze family diving suit. Now, we have a diving suit from Carl Gauze. There were three brothers, but Carl and Jack started a diving business after World War II, and they had, you know, your classic diving suit with the great big metal helmet, and you peer out through the porthole on it. And I've had the thing on my shoulders a couple times, and it weighs a good 80, 90 pounds. So this was not... You had to be in pretty good shape. The other thing is the diving boots that it came with would weigh you down and bring you down to the bottom of whatever lake you were in. And then they also included this great big knife that was used if you needed to cut something while you were down there. And, of course, you had this tube going up to the surface, and then you had something else that was going to haul you back up. So we got pictures of these guys cutting a hole in the ice And then they would go down there, and if you dropped your outboard motor in Crystal Lake, another job I know they were used for is they would look at the bottom of Worth Lake before they had the Aqua Follies there. They would send these guys down there to make sure that there were no broken bottles or things that people might cut themselves if they were jumping off those diving platforms or performing their synchronized swimming. We wouldn't want them to get hurt. They also left us with about 200 or 300 photos, black and white photos, of the bottoms of rivers, because they were sent to survey the bottoms of rivers for the Tennessee Valley Project and this big project over in North Minneapolis that Northern States Power did. I don't know what to do with these photos. They're not that interesting to look at, underwater photos of the bottoms of rivers. But the Gause family operated their diving business out of their home on Perry Avenue North in the 30s and 40s, and they took jobs for Northern States Power, again, the Tennessee Valley Authority, smaller jobs, including cleaning up the bottom of Worth Lake before the Aqua Follies and bringing up boats from the bottom of Lake Calhoun. Jack Gause taught over in Columbia Heights, and he was the wrestling coach because Robbinsdale is always wrestling, but he was over there for a good 30 years. He left us a note that in 1945, when he turned 15, my father, who thought everybody should be working no matter what, took me to East St. Louis, Illinois, and put me in a diving suit and put me down for my first job. When I came back from St. Louis, I went to work for Pearson's Electric over the summer. So at 15, I was working as an electrician and as a commercial diver. But one of the first things you see when you come into the Historical Society is that old diving helmet, and people are always asking us about that. And we have a few trophies from the 1940s, athletic trophies. You know, they have a wonderful collection of all the high school's trophies over what used to be Sandburg Junior High. And we should also just mention, in 1948, Herb Schopper comes up with this great idea. Herb was a great big guy. He didn't go to war. He was about 6'4 and 280-some pounds. And he was strange jobs. He had a popcorn machine repairman job. He worked at his mother's bakery, you know, all sorts of things. He was always a hard worker, but he finally came up with a great idea. He'd been whittling, and he thought he was whittling fishing lures when he got this idea for this little bug creation. And he liked board games. So he turned his bug creation into the game of Cootie. And eventually he got a manufacturer in Chicago to create the little plastic parts. And the legend is he had all sorts of people around town punching out these little plastic parts and putting them into compartments and putting them into these little boxes. And then he brought the boxes to Dayton's downtown. The game of Cootie was a huge hit. The early boxes are just these red and yellow things, and they say Robbinsdale, W.H. Schopper Manufacturing, Robbinsdale, Minnesota. Schopper's house still stands. It's at 38th and Hubbard. It's a nice old three-story house. I drove by it the other day just because I wanted to see it, and I imagine that looks much the way it did, from the outside anyway, in 1931. Now, the Schopper Game Company didn't last long in Robbinsdale. By his first move out of the house was into a plant in Minneapolis, and then later he built another plant in Golden Valley. But we still claim him, and over on West Broadway on our main street, we've got our great big Cootie bug, and someday I've always hoped that we could get more. So, like, Chicago has its cows, and St. Paul has its Peanuts characters. Red Wing has its boots. Robbinsdale should have its Cooties. We got one built. The guy did it for free. We're really grateful for him. But if we could just get 10 more Cooties around town, I think it would really make a statement and honor our history here in Robbinsdale.
Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one.
Bicycle into the city every Saturday to see our friends. Back home, sitting hand in hand, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, when the evening ends.
music is provided by Gabe Barnett and Them Rounders.